something has been wrong with, what to call it, Wall Street, big business, big money in America, something has been wrong with it for a long time. Those who invested in and placed faith in companies like Enron and Global Crossing and Tyco and WorldCom were cheated and fooled by individuals whose selfishness seemed so outsized, so huge, that it seems less human and flawed than kind of weird and puzzling. Did they think they would get away with accounting scams forever? Did they think it was okay? I began to reread Michael Novak. 20 years ago this summer, he published what I think is his masterpiece, The Spirit of Democratic Capitalism, a stunning book marked by clarity of expression and originality of thought. But it was also, I realized as I read this time, a response to the Pope's encyclical on work, or rather, perhaps it's best to say, an elaboration upon the encyclical. Novak says there is one great reason that capitalism is good. Of all the systems devised by man, it is the one most likely to lift the poor out of poverty. But capitalism cannot exist in a void. Capitalism requires an underlying moral edifice. Without it, nothing works. With it, all is possible. That edifice includes people who have an appreciation for and understanding of the human person. It requires a knowledge that business can contribute to community and family. It requires, too, a sense of sin, a sense of right and wrong, and an appreciation that the unexpected happens, that things take surprising turns in life. Michael Novak was speaking, he knew, to an international academic and intellectual community that, in the 1980s, still felt toward capitalism a kind of generalized contempt. Capitalism was selfish, exploitative, unequal, imperialistic. Novak himself had been a socialist when he was young, and he knew the critiques by heart, but he had come to see capitalism in a new way. Capitalism, like nature, wants to increase itself. It wants to grow and create. And as it does, it produces more. More goods, more services, more liberation, more creativity, more opportunity, more possibilities, more unanticipated ferment, more movement and action. So, capitalism was, to Novak, a public good, and he addressed its subtler critics. What of, quote, the corruption of affluence, the idea that while it is moral discipline that builds and creates success, success tends in time to corrupt and corrode moral discipline. Dad made the money with his guts, you spend it at your leisure. The result, goes this thinking, is an ethos of self-indulgence and greed and narcissism. Michael Novak answers by quoting the philosopher Jacques Maritain, who once observed that affluence, in fact, inspires us to look beyond the material for meaning in our lives. He said, it's exactly because people have bread that they realize you can't live by bread alone. In a paradoxical way, said Michael Novak, the more materially comfortable a society becomes, the more spiritual it is able to become. Its hunger's more markedly transcendent. Right now, Michael Novak certainly seems right about American society in general. We have not become worse people, I don't think, with the affluence of the past 20 years, and we have arguably, in some interesting ways, become better. After all, 40 years ago, men in the New York City borough of Queens ignored the screams of a waitress named Kitty Genovese in a story that became quite famous, as she was stabbed to death in an apartment building parking lot. But today, the men of Queens are famous for strapping 70 pounds of gear on their backs and charging into the Twin Towers. But it appears to me that the leaders of business, of Wall Street, of big accounting, have, many of them, become somewhat worse with affluence. I think of a man of celebrated rectitude who, if he returned to the Wall Street of his youth, would no doubt be welcomed back with cheers and derided behind his back as something of a sissy. He wouldn't dream of cooking the books. He wouldn't dream of calling costs profits. And I think he would never fit in. Michael Novak famously sees business as a vocation, a deeply serious one. Business to him is a stage, a platform on which men and women can each day take actions that are either ethical or unethical, helpful or not. When their actions are marked by high moral principle, they heighten their calling. They're suddenly not just in business, but part of a noble endeavor that adds to the sum total of human joy and progress. The work they do builds things, makes connections between people, forges community, spreads wealth, sets an example, creates a template, offers inspiration. The work they do changes the world. And in doing this work, they strengthen the ground on which democracy and economic freedom stand. Novak wrote, quote, "The calling of business is to support the reality and reputation of capitalism and not undermine it." Around this time, when I was reading Novak's book on work, I read something by Edward Yankins of the Acton Institute, who had distilled Michael Novak's philosophy into something he called seven great responsibilities for corporations. And they were: satisfy customers with good service of real value, make a reasonable return to investors, create new wealth, create new jobs, defeat cynicism and envy by demonstrating internally that talent and hard work will and can be rewarded, promote inventiveness, ingenuity, and creativity, and diversify the interests of the republic. Now, back to John Paul. John Paul was a European. He came of age during fascism and lived as an adult under communism. His view of economic freedom was largely a European one, heavily influenced by his era. The state isn't all bad, isn't all good. Some kind of combined socialist-capitalist system is probably to be desired. The poor must always be cared for, the ill taken in, healed, or comforted. Always, John Paul is more interested in the human person, including the individual as worker. I was interested to hear of what he said of Michael Novak's response to his encyclical when it first came out 20 years ago. John Paul read it and then is said to have told friends, "This is a good book." What about work in the arts? What about artists? It might seem odd that a pope would have devoted a great amount of time to pondering the role of the artist in society, but in this case it is not. John Paul, after all, as a student, thought he might become an actor. He appeared in local productions in college and the seminary, and it was clear he had a gift. He wrote plays as a young man and had felt called to playwriting. And he remained throughout his life a poet. In 1999, John Paul wrote a long letter to the artists of the world. I read it 2 years later, after September 11, 2001, when I had come to see my work as more than a way of taking part in the world and earning my living. Writing about the human drama that surrounded the event of 9/11, the valor of the firemen and how none walk through fire but for love, the pain and anguish of those who lost friends and family members, the brave search of so many people for the meaning of the event, and the honest search for lessons and understanding. Writing about this in the year after 9/11, I began to experience another dimension in my own work and another reason for doing it. I wanted to serve. I wanted to honor. I wanted to see in a new way and speak of our connectedness as human beings. And I wanted to be truthful to point out what I believed I saw: a return on the part of the culture to admiration for an old style of manhood, the kind that takes responsibility and serves others, and a renewed cultural sense in my beloved New York that religion is not something we should hold utterly private or be mildly embarrassed about, but rather something we can hold high, not with aggression, not with pride, God knows, but with love and gratitude. Well, I have had few times in my professional life when I could feel that what I was doing was attempting something like art, something like painting, with the portrait painter's fierce desire to make it true and capture the subject. And at that time, after 9/11, I did feel that way. I was trying to come close to art, and that is when I read the Pope's letter. A glimmer of God's work at the dawn of creation can be seen in the eyes of an artist, the Pope asserts. Artists are captivated by the hidden power of sounds and words and colors and shapes. This, John Paul says, is both an echo of creation and also God's way of associating you as a person with His creation. He wrote, "The opening pages of the Bible present God as a kind of exemplar of everyone who produces a work. The human craftsman mirrors the Creator." In producing a work and expressing themselves, John Paul says, artists' work becomes a unique disclosure of their own being. In shaping a masterpiece, quote, "the artist not only summons his work into being, but also in some way reveals his own personality by means of it." Art is thus an exceptional mode of expression for spiritual growth. Because the artist communicates with his fellow men, the history of art is not only a story of works produced, but also a story of men and women. But the artist's vocation is in the service of beauty. When God looked at what He'd made, He saw not only that it was good, but that it was beautiful. The Pope wrote, "In a certain sense, beauty is the visible form of the good." That's interesting. Beauty is the visible form of the good. And all art, he said, is a constant striving. Every genuine artistic intuition goes beyond what the senses perceive. The artistic intuition springs from the human soul and grasps, if only fleetingly and imperfectly, quote, "the mysterious unity of things." All artists experience the gap between what they do and the perfection of the beauty glimpsed in the ardor of the creative moment. What an artist manages to express in a painting or a creation is no more than a glimmer of splendor. Art is hard. The true artist nears God in his work, is overwhelmed, and can only stammer in reply. But true artists, the Pope says, know this. They know, as St. Paul said, quote, "God does not dwell in shrines made of human hands." And yet their perseverance is an act of faith. The closer the artist comes to beauty, the closer he comes to Christ. To journey toward truth is to journey toward God. In the murk is the mystery. And in the mystery is all creation and the Creator. I would read this and ponder. In 2004, I had a conversation with an artist who'd been doing the same thing, reading the same thing and pondering too. He is the actor Jim Caviezel, who portrayed Christ in The Passion of the Christ. I spoke to him by phone when he was in Rome just after he met with John Paul. The Passion had just opened, with all its many surrounding dramas. Some in the Vatican had attempted to help the film when it came under the fire of charges that it was anti-Semitic. The Pope was shown the film and was quoted as saying, by some who were there, quote, "It is as it was." The meaning of that statement seemed to be the film was not vicious, not hateful, but an attempt to artistically render the truth. The quote, "It is as it was reported to me by the film's producer, who, of course, had reason to want it disseminated. I contacted the Pope's press spokesman, Dr. Navarro-Valls, and told him what I had been told, repeating to him the exact words I was told the Pope had said. He gave me permission to report it, and I did as others did. But within days, the Vatican came to fear that it had become unnecessarily embroiled in a great controversy, and one that was showing up on page one of the New York Times. Dr. Navarro-Valls then told a reporter he had never given anyone permission to use such a quote or such a phrase. He also suggested that I had invented our email correspondence. This put me on the spot, to say the least. I went to the Wall Street Journal with Dr. Navarro-Val's email to me. We traced it back to the Vatican and to the press office. I duly reported this fact. Dr. Navarro-Val's then had no response. It was all quite a mess, with the New York Times criticizing me on one hand as a supporter of an anti-Semitic film and the Vatican attacking my integrity. I think I will never forget, in the middle of the drama, going to a book party for a friend who is a writer in Manhattan. There, I bumped into the gossip columnist Liz Smith in a circle of very sophisticated and chattering New Yorkers. She looked at me and teased me. She said, "Well, you're in the fire." I laughed and said, "I guess I was." Then I said, "You know, I am either being misled and abused by cynical Hollywood producers or by the Vatican of my great faith. Which do you think it is?" "The Vatican," they all replied with great confidence, and we laughed, because it was a surprising thing to think, and yet it is what appeared to be true. At any rate, soon the Vatican, embarrassed by its awkward maneuvers, other reporters had come forward with their own experiences of having been told of the Pope's quote. The Vatican decided to make things up by having the star of the movie in to see John Paul. His blessing, they no doubt thought, would make clear once and for all the Pope's support of the film. Jim Caviezel, an ardent Catholic and a gifted actor, was thrilled to meet the man he told me was his hero. By phone, after the meeting, he spoke of the recent controversy, he thanked me for my stand, and he said he would be grateful if I could report what had transpired between him and John Paul. What he wanted to tell me was this: on seeing the Pope and taking his hand, he found himself thinking of John Paul's letter to the artists of the world. Caviezel told me, quote, "I read it several times when I was a young actor. It was very important to me. It came out, and I remember what he said is that part of the truth, right, is accepting. You can't just write about darkness and say, this is the way it is. Because light always comes through. It must. If you went into a 40,000-foot warehouse, even if you just lit one match, the match would pierce the darkness. It pierces even in the vast amount of darkness. And as I see it, the movie is a light. It is a match. So the first thing I began to talk about to the Pope was his letter to the artists. I told him it gave me great strength in my life and my career. And I thanked him. I said, thank you." Now, the Pope is a very holy man. He's seen the Nazis and the communists, and there were people he knew that understand what a regime is like and what they do and how they can take your freedom from you. He's seen it. This is the Pope from Fatima. I think the guy's a mystic. I think he's a saint. He said, "I'm not impressed by celebrity. That word is bad when you're standing in front of a saint. But something moved me. I know he is a saint." Caviezel told me he asked for the Pope's blessing for himself and his work and his family. And he spoke to John Paul of the passion itself, of artistic decisions that had been made in its filming. Caviezel told me, "I always knew if it's gonna rock, you have to have Mary prominent in the film story. There are different Christian traditions and ways and views, but let the Holy Spirit do his work in that area. I'm not denying the mother. What her son said on the cross, 'Mother, behold your son, son, behold your mother,' it's one of the seven things Jesus said on the cross. He said it. You can't leave it out. So if you include it, you have to develop it. You have to tell the story, and you have to show it. He was giving his mother to the world. He gave his mother to John and to the world." Caviezel told John Paul that he had noticed that the Pope had boldly put the M on your crest. Caviezel told the Pope, quote, "She is the one, I think, who made the movie for her son." Caviezel told me, "I told the Pope, your statement, your example." I told him, "She knew the great pain. We put her son to death for saying, 'Be a good person.'" Well, he told the truth. The truth cuts like a sword. That's the sword right there. Be a good person. Caviezel told me, "In the world we make good as evil and evil as good. But here's a guy, the Pope, who doesn't do that. He carries a lot of crosses. I don't know how he functions. And there's politics everywhere, everywhere. But Peggy, the church will survive. It'll be here when we're dust." And then Caviezel spoke to me as an artist who'd just been through a grueling artistic endeavor. He said, "When this whole thing began, I met one day with Mel Gibson and we're talking about other roles and then stories in the Bible, and he's looking at me and watching me, and I said, 'You want me to play Jesus, don't you?' And he said, 'Yeah.' Well, Peggy, your life builds up to things. When you're asked a question, when the whole history of your life comes to that moment, 'You want me to play Christ, don't you?' Then God gives you a grace inside your heart that says, 'Look, this is where I need you.'" Caviezel said, "One of the great saints, I read her, is Maria de Agreda, a mystic. She wrote that Mary said, 'If you truly follow my son, scandal will follow you all your life.'" "But okay," said Caviezel, "if they persecute you, they persecuted Christ first." Caviezel continued in talking about the movie, "Miraculous things have happened. I was hit by lightning during the filming of a crucifixion scene. It was the one day I didn't have communion. We always had Mass and I always received communion, but on that one day the priest ran out of hosts. Well, we're filming and I was up there on the cross and I was hit. And we knew I was going to be hit. We could see the lightning coming. And the eyes of the men below me turned glossy. Everything turned pink. There was fire coming from both sides of my head. And Peggy, there was a sound. It was like the sound of the planes hitting the buildings on 9/11. It was a weird, guttural, discordant sound. It was not like an explosion. And then afterwards, I heard the sound when they played one of the films, the videotape of the World Trade Center on 9/11 on television." And he said, "It was like a shock. That is the sound of the lightning. The plane going into the building, that's what the lightning sounded like." Caviezel continued, "This is a very intense time in my life. The first part of my life was a leading up to this. It was a preparation for this. You learn a lot. You shouldn't hold on to things, to neuroses. People, artists, think they have to hold on to their neuroses and their pains, or they won't be a good actor anymore or a good artist. Well, that's not true. That's the liar. The liar tells you things like that. You hold on to your pains and your neuroses, you'll just wind up a lonely person. People become lonely with time, and the fame has moved on to someone else. You have to heal. You have to maintain relationships and get rid of dysfunction and neuroses. That's why we say the Our Father, 'Deliver us from evil.'" Caviezel continued, "I get letters from people saying, 'You swore in this movie,' or whatever. And I always reply, I say, 'Yes, I play sinners.'" I asked him at the end of our conversation how long he had spoken to John Paul. He paused and then said he didn't know. He said, "I can't really remember. It wasn't longer than 5 minutes with me and 10 minutes with my family, I think. All I know is when I left, I was happy. I just felt happiness. And we all left together." I thought that was a beautiful rendering of a moment, and in a way, of his own life that Jim Caviezel gave me. One senses he will go on to great work, for he is that best kind of artist, one who knows he's just another worker in the vineyard who has much to do and none of it without meaning.